Picking up where we left off in chapter 3, shock troops in Iran and Egypt. Maybe some little bit of repetition here. By the way, dispensing with the audio intros and outros just to facilitate things. Let's see. Part of the learnings from this book are that you can't take much of anything at face value on the news because there are so many behind the scenes possibilities. This chapter, you know, mentions false flag attacks on mosques and public figures in the party's name. These groups were more than just provocateurs, they were shock troops who acted as if they were the certain people throwing rocks at mosques and priests. And we've seen that mentioned in the recent news around the world with protests. People paid to do stuff. Another fascinating thing that I find reading this book is, as they say, they being mystics and indigenous peoples, and that's an overlap there, and whoever says it, that there is no, you know, past, present, or future, really, that things are timeless in a way, and truly timeless, though we experience the time. So while I'm reading this book about the, quote, past, it's so relevant to what's going on currently in the news that I feel like it's like, you know, putting into clear form what's going on now in a way, and also teaching me the sort of possibilities. So when I see a news story or I read a bit, I think, okay, well, I read that in the past, so now I see that this is possible. So those are just some of my insights. And a lot of this stuff, again, summed up with you know, the payoffs, people that can be bought. Here's a reference where they're referring to, I think, some guy in Iran. We could not count on Kashani giving Persia that minimum of order and stability, which is our basic need, the Foreign Office concluded. The minimum order of instability, which is our basic need. That sums up a lot of shit. I noted a la reform, not revolution. So there's a certain level of which things need to proceed, business as usual, economic flows, resource flows, wining and dining, that kind of stuff. At some level, that whole flow, that there's an order of stability. And so that's one of the MO blueprints in this book, which get to later on in this section about maintaining a certain level of stability. And here they have a mention of somebody, Islamic members would act as foot soldiers of the Islamic Revolution of 1979, helping to implement the wholesale introduction of Islamic law in Iran. Islamic law in Iran. And restoring the monarchy in the U.S. Here's an amazing statistic control. The Shah soon assumed all powers and became the, quote, dictator, unquote, preferred by the British ambassador. The following year, a new consortium was established controlling the production and export of Iranian oil, in which the U.S. and Britain each secured a 40% interest. So, you know, just like with Iraq in 2003 and stuff, where there were maps of the oil companies just literally dividing up the stuff. Now here they have a joke, a standing joke in Persia, that if you picked up a clergyman's beard, you would see the words "Made in England" stamped on the other side. And then later it says, although exaggerating with her "Made in England" claim, Ashraf neatly summed up the British view of the Islamists, that they could be used to counter the threat to British interests. During the 1951-53 coup planning period, Kashani was seen by the British as too much of an anti-Western liability to be a strategic ally, but his forces could be used to prepare the way for the installation of pro-Western figures and be dropped as soon as their tasks for the imperial powers had been performed. So another factor we see, can learn from this book, is how in the news, you know, things can turn depending on actions, depending on people, depending on which way things are leaning or have gone or going, and someone's use. And now this British Empire stuff is certainly the much of a blueprint for the U.S. Empire, because they literally use people. They use people for their purpose, and then when that purpose is done, it's have a not so nice day. Well, luckily, if you're lucky, have a nice day, depending on the role you're playing in this stuff. Now, a lot of this stuff too in Iran has to do with the Suez Canal, which is a major oil transport route. And let's see, just going to read some bits here. By this time, the Egyptian government was offering Hodabai enormous bribes to keep the Muslim Brotherhood from engaging in further violence against the regime. So the Muslim Brotherhood plays a huge role in mostly helping out Jordan and Britain. But because of their Muslim, is not totally under the British rule and stuff like that. So and Nasser was the Egyptian president, and eventually in 70 Sadat comes in. Another thing I like about reading history now is that names that I heard a while back and I'm familiar with, but I don't really know where to place them, it helps with that, as here the mention of Anwar Sadat. And another example of divide and rule: from the limited information available, British strategy appears to be traditional divide and rule aimed at gaining leverage over the new regime in pursuit of its own interests. The British cultivation of the Brotherhood could only heighten tensions between the regime and the Brotherhood and strengthen the latter's position. Internal British memos indicate that British officials told Nasser about some of their meetings with Hodabi and other members of the Brotherhood, naturally assuring him that London was doing nothing underhand. However, the very fact that they were taking place surely instilled doubt in Nasser's mind over the trustworthiness of the Brotherhood. At this time, British officials believed that the Brotherhood and its paramilitary groups were at the disposal of the military authorities, and that the Brotherhood wanted to make the regime pay some kind of price for its support for it, such as introducing an Islamic constitution. So it gets a little convoluted with who's doing what, but anyhow. And here we have my assessment, which I had heard before from this book, is that Prime Minister Winston Churchill was a big jerk. Now, I don't know all of this stuff. He may have done some other stuff too, but here's an example. After the failed assassination attempt against Nasser, Prime Minister Churchill sent a personal message to him saying, "I congratulate you on your escape from the dastardly attack made on your life at Alexandria yesterday evening." Soon, however, the British were again conspiring with the same people to achieve the same end. 3 years into the new regime, Nasser's domestic reforms included widespread land redistribution benefiting the rural poor, and moves towards enshrining a constitutional form of government to replace tributary rule. So again, it pushes my button a bit when you got these people fucking with other people's countries. It's, it's all in the name of resource colonialism empire. But, and just to see that is what that's like what they do. Okay, some more quotes. The British and Americans were by now involved in a variety of coup plots against Syria and Saudi Arabia, as well as Egypt, as part of a much bigger planned reorganization of the Middle East to counter the, quote, virus of Arab nationalism, end quote. According to a top-secret Foreign Office memo, U.S. President Eisenhower described to the British the need for a, quote, a high-class Machiavellian plan to achieve a situation in the Middle East favorable to our interests, end quote, which could split the Arabs and defeat the aims of our enemies. And there's Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, who was, kind enough to tell us about the military-industrial congressional complex. I think that was left out, I later learned. And let's see, further down the page, if we allow, if we allowed Nasser to get away with his Suez Canal coup, the consequence would be to put an end to the monarchy in Saudi Arabia, explained the permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office, Ivan Kirkpatrick, fearing that nationalist forces there would be inspired by Nasser's successful defiance of the West in Egypt. So again, it's all about the controlling nationalism and waves of people, in this case Arab persuasion, from gaining more power. And we see that playing out nowadays in various sectors of the world. King Hussein's regime in Jordan gave Brotherhood leaders diplomatic passports to facilitate their movements to organize against Nasser, while Saudi Arabia provided funding. The CIA also approved Saudi Arabia's funding of the Muslim Brotherhood to act against Nasser, according to the former CIA officer Robert Baer, B-A-E-R. In August 1956, the Egyptian authorities uncovered a British spy ring in the country and arrested four Britons, including James Swinburne, the business manager of the Arab news agency, the M16 Front, based in Cairo. So it goes on and on with all the intrigue and other crazy shit. Let's see, in this chapter 3 ends, in both Iran and Egypt, therefore, Britain was prepared to secretly connive with Islamist forces, using them for imperial ends as part of its arsenal of weapons in covert action. These groups were not considered as strategic allies, but rather recognized as avowedly anti-British. What is striking is that Britain resorted to working with these forces in the knowledge that they were even more anti-British than the regimes Whitehall was trying to overthrow. Now that is, it's, as they say, it would be very funny if it wasn't so sad, that the British started to working with these forces that they were even more anti-British than the regimes they were trying to overthrow. Their utility was their muscle and ability to influence events, acting as shock troops to help a desperate Britain retain some influence in a post-war world where its power was on the wane. The resort to collaborating with forces, however anti-British or however much of an anathema to long-term interests, would recur in later decades, even when avowedly jihadist terrorist groups came into the picture. And then it's on to chapter 4, after showing the shock troops in Iran and Egypt. This gets into the Islam versus nationalism. You'll see where it connects loosely many dots to what's going on nowadays. It starts off, the latter half of the 1950s was a period of great flux and convulsion in the Middle East. The dominant conflict was between two contending forces. On the one hand, the secular nationalist regimes in the region led by Egypt's Nasser, and including Syria, and after the 1958 revolution that overthrew its pro-British monarch, Iraq. And on the other hand, the Islamic pro-Western monarchies of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Gulf states like Oman and Kuwait. Britain scrambled to shore up the later states in the face of the very real danger that the popular radical republican ideas emanating mainly from Cairo would spread to the oil-rich states, thereby depriving British and U.S. corporations of control over the world's primary commodity, oil. And it's also mentioned that they throw in communism coming from other places as a key factor, too. And then you have British oil companies, mainly BP and Shell, produced around 1/6 of the world's oil, mainly in the Gulf, where they had large stakes in Kuwait and Iran and handled over 1/3 of the international oil trade. So a little bit of heat noise perhaps in the background. So, you know, the Lakota fat taker comes to mind. And here's another Foreign Office memo, 1958. Our interest lies in keeping Kuwait independent and separate, if we possibly can, in line with the idea of maintaining the four principal oil-producing areas, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, and Iraq, under separate political control. And then blah, 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 to stave off the possibility of further nationalist upheavals following the revolution in Iraq. The nationalist challenge to British interests was rooted in the desire of people in the Middle East, long ruled formally or informally by foreigners, to control their own resources and to become truly independent. Oh my God, to control their own resources and to become truly independent. How democratic. How native. And, you know, it gets into Africa as well. Africa resources, that's a whole other side story mentioned a little bit in this book. The next section starts, when Nasser expelled the Muslim Brothers from Egypt in the clampdown in 54, many found refuge in Saudi Arabia, whither their evacuation was helped by the CIA. Welcomed by the Saudi ruling family, the brothers' conservative right-wing credentials, I'm accentuating things that a thing here, right-wing credentials allowed them to integrate quickly into Saudi society, some rising to positions of influence in banking and Islamic education. The Egyptian Brotherhood was soon joined by Syrians and Iraqis on the run from the nationalist regimes which had seized power in those countries during the wave of upheavals. In Europe, too, exiled brothers began setting up networks, forming an international branch in Munich, directed by Saeed Ramadan. Now, I highlighted this as a key turning point because you have the factions, and you have a lot of what we heard about when we first heard about Al-Qaeda was these, you know, international branches. Here it mentions Munich, and you have different, you know, quote, radical Islamists going to other countries, and these various alliances that are bringing Europe into it big time. So quite fascinating. Yeah, I have a note here. Repression of nationalism led to international bullshit. Repression of nationalism, and then sort of out the side comes the international side effects, or what some call blowback. Ray Close, a former CIA station chief in Riyadh, states that, quote, the Saudis were very tolerant of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they encouraged it in Egypt, Sudan, and elsewhere, but they were adamantly opposed to the Brotherhood activity inside Saudi Arabia. Another laughable hypocrisy, if it wasn't so sad, that the Saudis are encouraging this group, who are Muslim, outside of their own country, but God forbid they do it inside their own country. By the late 1950s, the CIA was also starting to fund the Brotherhood. It is alleged that in conjunction with the U.S. oil company Aramco and the Saudi authorities, the CIA sponsored the creation of small religious cells in Saudi Arabia opposed to Arab nationalism. So they may have eventually actually supported some of that in the country, who knows here. But anyway, by the late 1950s, the British had become reconciled to the rise of U.S.-supported Saudi power, since London had no other option and since it was becoming more aware of the Saudis' usefulness as an Anglo-American proxy for covert operations in the region. Just skipping, kind of going to skip around to read the bits I have highlighted. The Brotherhood's utility in Syria. Anglo-American plans to counter Arab nationalism took other forms than building up the Saudis. In 1956 and 7, there were at least two Anglo-American plots which planned to overthrow governments in Syria. Although neither was ultimately carried out, the planning behind them illustrates Anglo-American willingness to work again with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Foreign Office's preference was therefore to enlist Iraq, a quote, brother Arab, end quote, to the task of, quote, winning Syria to our camp, end quote. And as M16's Deputy Director George Young described it, Turkey would create border incidents, the Iraqis would stir up the desert tribes, and the Parti Populaire Syrien in Lebanon would infiltrate the borders until mass confusion justified the use of invading Iraqi troops. So there's the empire of chaos, and you can't take news at face value at work. Also found it sort of ironic, the name of the Fertile Crescent, named for the region. As well as approaching tribes along the Syria-Iraq border, Operation Straggle involved trying to enlist the Muslim Brotherhood in creating unrest in the country. British officials were well aware of the rising political power of the Syrian Brotherhood. In December 54, General Gardner told Anthony Eden, then Foreign Secretary, of monster demonstrations arranged by the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, which took place after Egypt's clampdown against the movement. Another official noted that the Brotherhood have succeeded in a comparatively short time in establishing an influential position in Syria. But the effects of this were not positive to British interests, since they would only increase existing tendencies to nationalism and anti-Western feeling. Thus, once again, similar to policy in Iran and Egypt, Britain was covertly conniving with Islamist forces to achieve a special objective while recognizing them as being detrimental to long-term British interests. So another factor I see in this is how there's that level of uncontrollability. Sometimes I read news and I wonder, you know, wow, why did that happen? And I see that with these various groups that, you know, they're using some of them so... If their preferences, whether it's religious or political, become more prominent, then they can turn, and then, in fact, then that turns on the original plan, but they sort of don't care because, like it says, they're the, in this case, the British Empire is is using them, and they see them as not in their long-term interests. But then again, you know, something has to change in what gets said for the reasons. So reading the news with looking for what's behind or between the lines. And here I have this blueprint modus operandi with seemingly what's going on with Syria nowadays. But this is talking about Syria then. Something called the Preferred Plan. It was circulated by a secret working group in Washington. The Preferred Plan, carried out in coordination with the Iraqi, Jordanian, Lebanese intelligence services, again aimed at stirring up the tribes on the Syria-Iraq border, and also the Druze community in the south of the country, as well as utilizing Syrian M16 agents working inside the Ba'ath Party. The plan read, CIA is prepared and Secret Intelligence Service, or M16, will attempt to mount minor sabotage and coup de main incidents within Syria, working through contacts with individuals. Also, CIA and SIS should use their capabilities in both the psychological and action fields to augment tension in Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon. The plan also incorporated another typical feature of British agitation, violent false flag operations, blame for which would be pinned on official enemies, which had proved successful in removing Mujahideen from power in Iran. Thus, staged frontier incidents and border clashes would provide a pretext for Iraqi and Jordanian military intervention. Syria had to be made to appear as the sponsor of plots, sabotage, and violence directed against neighboring governments. This meant operations taking the form of sabotage, national conspiracies, and various strong arm activities to be blamed on Damascus. And you know, when I read this stuff, it's like think about Rodney King, can we all get along? And when I think about all my relations, all the relations that widely original people's philosophy and way of being, this stuff is like virtually the opposite, where it's all about strategy and using people and getting stuff. It's sad. Just another example of, let's see, October, Nabulsi's plan was to align Jordan with Syria and Egypt, thereby breaking Jordan's long-standing dependence on the West. In response, the CIA engaged in plots to sow disagreement between Nabulsi and Hussein and to discredit Nabulsi and Nasser in order to provide a pretext for Hussein to act against his prime minister. And this was a neat summary of Britain's preference for repressive regimes backed by the Islamic right rather than more popular or democratic governments. So there again is the what I'm calling the blueprint MO. Britain's preference for repressive regimes backed by the Islamic right rather than more popular or democratic governments or nationalistic. Later on, thus Johnston was saying that although the Brotherhood was anti-Western, it was also opposed to communism and nationalism, Britain's two principal enemies. And here's an example that shows how things can turn. I mentioned King Hussein's call for British intervention in Jordan provoked a critical response from the Jordanian Muslim Brotherhood, which organized anti-British demonstrations in Amman. In response, Hussein's regime arrested Brotherhood leader Abdul Rahman Khalifa, releasing him 3 months later, and continued to curb the organization's political activities. The episode showed that while the Brotherhood could be useful in providing support to reactionary pro-British regimes in times of crisis, as in 1957, it was a liability when it came to Western intervention in the region. And then the last section of this Islam versus nationalism chapter gets into an area I know very little about, Indonesia. At the time, the most populous Muslim nation, there was something called the Non-Aligned Movement that committed 29 states. This included Indonesia's Ahmad Sukarno, a nationalist who in 1955 had played a key role with Nasser, India's Jawaharlal Nehru, and Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah in founding the Non-Aligned Movement. This committed 29 states, representing over half the world's population, to opposing imperialism and membership of any great power bloc. So this is, again, flavors of this in with various alliances going on now, Latin America and China, Iran and Russia. We have Britain's major role in the operation was to make available to the U.S. its military bases in Malaya and Singapore, then still colonies. Another factor in the strategy stuff is, you know, land grabs, which are then used for effect for other to get to, or to, you know, have war strategy to another place, which, you know, in effect is the definition of one of the definitions of empire. So last bit of this chapter, talking about a guy, Darul Islam, is an organization, a group, leader Kartosu Virjo. The colonels and their allies in Darul Islam were seen as proxy forces, London's and Washington's shock troops, similar to the Muslim Brotherhood and the Iranian Ayatollahs, used for their nuisance value. They were dropped when they had outlived their utility. Undermining the main enemy was a short-term goal that, for a time at least, needed to be achieved at all cost, irrespective of the longer-term implication. So that's through Chapter 5, only about, gosh, about a little less than a quarter of the way through this fascinating book, chock full of information. Just to give you the preview, the next Chapter 5 is the Global Islamic Mission. Then I'll just read the chapter titles. Handy weapons in Jordan and Egypt, the Saudi and Iranian revolutions, traveling in terrorism, the Afghan jihad, the dictator, the king, and the Ayatollah, nurturing Al-Qaeda, Pakistan's surge into Central Asia, a covert war in Bosnia, killing Gaddafi, overthrowing Saddam, intrigues in the Southern Balkans, 9/11 connections, Londonistan, a green light to terrorism, 7/7 and the London-Islamabad axis, alliances of moderation, allied to the enemy, Iraq and Afghanistan, good and bad revolutions, the Arab Spring. So, very, seems like required reading in a way for understanding what's going on today. So thanks for listening. Have a good one.